Hey everybody, welcome to another edition of Magical Musings. Please join us for the next 2 hours while Brian and Joy talk about everything that is related to paganism, except that you won't learn in the books. So tonight's topic is on Imbolc. It's part of our holiday series, and this is actually episode 11 of our Magical Musings offerings. So come on and let's get started. Okay.
Welcome, folks.
Yeah, hi everyone. We first, before we start out, I want to give a shout out to one listener who actually started writing into us, who found us through iTunes of all places. Her name is Anna M. Sato, S-O-T-O, Sato, I think that's right. She's telling us how she thought that we had hundreds of thousands of listeners and wanted to get circulation, and I'm like, I think we maybe have a dozen that we can verify. She was surprised. So I wanted to say hi to her. Big shout out. And then we get into tonight's episode. Like I said, tonight's episode is on Imbolc. I've been thinking about Letha because the last couple of nights, what has been happening is I've been coming up with a structure to the Wheel of the Year. The Wheel of the Year is apparently one of those... I am reinventing the wheel. It's one of those concepts that's like pan-pagan. Everybody knows it, and nobody really questions why it's like this.
Fair enough.
So what we're going to do is, before we start talking about Imbolc specifically, I want everybody to get into a comfortable position where they're sitting upright. Like they were going to fall into a meditative state, but not a meditation. This is actually going to be a guided visualization rather than a guided meditation. You're not going to drop into a trance, but I'm going to describe a scene to you, and you are going to see it in your head, okay? So if everybody's comfortable, I want you to take a deep breath and release it and relax a little bit and close your eyes. Now, what I want you to see in front of you is a circle, all right? The circle is a hollow circle. It is just a hoop that goes around. The circle itself is colored, let's say, silver, and it is going to be, the line is approximately going to be maybe the thickness of a dime, or penny, or coin, so that there is some definition there. And it is, like I said, it's silver. Now, once you have this in front of you, say about a foot across in diameter, so that it's substantial, so that you can see it, I want you to divide it from the north to the south with just one line. And then I want you to divide it again from east to west, so you're quartering it. Okay, and these lines that are dividing it are very thin lines. They're enough that you know that they're there, but they're not overwhelming anything. Now divide the circle again, going from northwest to southeast, and once again from northeast to southwest. And these two lines, I want you to make the same color as the rim of the circle, the same thickness, and have them project out about an inch or so outside of the circle on each end. Now, once you have that, this is the basic structure of the Wheel of the Year. We're going to take the northwestern section of the line, and we're going to label that one Samhain. Opposite that, in the southeastern section, we're going to label that one Beltania. And in the northeastern section, we're going to label that one Imbolc, which is today's topic. And opposite it, in the southwest, we're going to label that Luznada. If you can't spell that, label it Letha and move on, because we're going to deal with that later. It's got a lot of names. Now, the north part is the holiday that we just finished celebrating not too long ago, and that is midwinter, also known as winter solstice. And opposite that in the south, that is the summer solstice. And on the east, we're going to label that the spring equinox, and in the west, we're going to label that the autumn equinox. The reason we're calling these the solstices and equinoxes is because it seems like every different group of pagans out there have a different name for this. Be it Alban something, be it Mabon, or whatever. So just to make it simple, we're going to use the celestial names for it, which is the solstices and equinoxes. Now take a minute, if you want, pause it here, pause the podcast here, and write this down. Write it out in your book of shadows, put it on your on a piece of paper, do it on your wall if you want, I don't care. But if you need a visual representation to look at occasionally, I want you to have a visual reference. Okay, so if you're done with that, the reason that I had you imagine this structure is because it's a very elegant one. We're going to notice one thing. With the thick lines that are dividing the circle in an X, you have four quadrants. The top quadrant, consisting of two small pieces, right around winter solstice, in the middle, is obviously the winter time. To the left, to the right, going clockwise, we have spring. To the south, we have summer. And to the west, we have autumn. And this is the cycle. Winter, spring, summer, autumn. Everybody should know this, if you simply are alive on the planet, because this is the cycle of seasons. This cycle
in the northern hemisphere.
Right. Well, it also It also works in the southern hemisphere. You just have to flip it. You rotate it around 180 degrees, and you get the same cycle going from winter to spring to summer to autumn, just in the opposite times. If you superimpose,
and then in the tropics, it's just a straight line the whole year.
So. Well, this is true, but we're not talking about, you know, the odd places. We're just talking about the observable, what our ancestors would have worshipped. Okay. One of the questions that comes out any time you have a discussion about the holidays is, okay, we have observable celestial phenomena of the solstices and equinoxes. Okay, because if somebody sits down, I can imagine back, you know, I don't know, thousands and thousands of years ago, some scholars sitting down and going, okay, there are 500 minutes in this day, and then the sun goes down. And then the next day, he's going, okay, we went 498 minutes this day. And on the next day, he's, okay, now we're at 495 minutes, and so on. And each day, the number of minutes that the sun is up reduces itself. Till he gets towards fuel and is really panicking at this point, going, okay, we're down to 212 minutes of sunshine, and the sun is going away, and we're all going to die. And then the next day he's like, well, wait a second, we've got, yesterday we had 211 minutes of sunshine, and now we have 213 minutes of sunshine. Maybe I screwed up someplace. I'm going to have to remeasure this tomorrow. And then on the next day, he's like, okay, well, now we have 215 minutes of sunshine. What? That's 2 days in a row. So he's kind of nervous, but he's hoping. And on the next day, he's got 218 minutes of sunshine. And now he's like celebrating because the sun is coming back. We're not all going to die. Hey! And if you think about the dates for a second, the shortest day of the year is on Yule. And 3 days later, we have a massive celebration that the whole world has with Christmas and Christmas Eve and whatever. And what I think happened was is that you had the observable phenomenon of the shortest day. And then once it's confirmed on a consistent basis that the sun is coming back and it's not going away, they had a big party, which happens to fall right at the 25th. And so we keep going throughout the year, and the days keep getting longer, and now we're getting up to midsummer, the summer solstice. And we have, okay, so now we have 680 minutes of sunshine. And the next day we have 674 minutes of sunshine? What's happening? Because now the sun is going away. And once they were able to measure this a few times, they realized, okay, during this time period in this season, when it's cold, we have a short day and we have a long night. Then somewhere along the line, we have days that are equal to how long the nights are. And then we have a really long day and a very short night. And then we have it equalize out again. And so this was the first observation of the solstices and equinoxes. Okay, and so understandably, mankind, or actually I should say personkind, would celebrate these because these are natural nature observing changes that are consistent, and they were used as a measurement of the year. Okay, well, because this seemed to kind of the seasons kind of seemed to rotate around these two axes. The solstices and equinoxes. You put those as kind of the middle, and you have to figure out a time period in between them. So you go from, let's say, the winter solstice, shortest day of the year, and you go until you see that the days are equal length, which would cover a block from Yule to whatever the spring equinox is. I got to get my own chart out here. I need a visualization. And you kind of divide that in half and go, okay, well, here's this time period where it's kind of halfway between both of them, both of those time periods. So now you have a time period where it's transitioned from one season to another. You go from the cold time into the life is starting to wake up time. And that's called embolic. And you
well,
do,
I mean,
go ahead.
Sorry, it just occurs to me that, I mean, there are, that's one way to calculate it. And you know, in some places they use the full moon nearest that holiday. And actually, there was a point made in some book or other that I read ages ago that one of the most natural ways to determine that period of time is based actually out of the name of the holiday itself, Imbolc. Oymilk, whatever you may call it, actually comes from, I think it's an Irish term meaning in milk, and it's referring to the period in the year where sheep are giving birth to lambs, and so they're in milk, and that is technically the first sort of mark that the year is beginning again.
Okay. And that is consistent as long as you're dealing with the northern hemisphere. If you're dealing with the southern hemisphere, things kind of get a little messed up. So I'm just talking about the celestial and how they would start measuring this and observing it and how these holidays might spontaneously develop, I guess you could call it, although it's not really spontaneous.
Fair enough.
There it is. Okay, so Ostara, that's right, Ostara. Anyway, I got my visualization up now. So you have, you know, embolic, and then they do that again with the time period from the spring equinox to the summer solstice, and they call that one, you know, whatever. The names aren't really that important. It's the transitions between one period and another. And I've asked just about all of my teachers this question. Why are the time periods on the thick lines of your mental wheel of the year called fire festivals and the actual observable celestial phenomenons of the equinoxes and solstices called the cross quarters and minor sabbats? And everybody's like, and I don't really ever get an answer. The only thing that I can figure is that when you have a time period that you can observe is the middle of something, you naturally classify a period before and after as the beginning and end. So as you look at the visual representation, you have Samhain as the beginning of winter. Yule as midwinter, Imbolc as the end of winter, beginning of spring, Ostara as mid-spring, Beltane as the end of spring, beginning of summer, and so forth. And because it was a transition from one season to another, that's why those became the most celebrated ones. Now, here's another piece of trivia in that the reason that they're called fire festivals is because these four major Sabbats, Samhain, Imbolc, Beltane, and Lusnada, were used as times to rekindle your fires and to bless the fields, bless the people, bless the crops, bless the animals with fires to purify them. That's why you have in Beltane the Beltane fires, the bone fires, where you have in Lusnada times where you drive the herds between two huge bonfires to bless them, where you snuff all the fires in the kingdom and relight them all during Samhain, and the fires carried all over the kingdom from the druid's original fire, and so forth. Okay? They all have fire as a central piece to the mythology. You know, and I never really got a good answer to it until I actually started thinking about why. And this was the best explanation that I could come up with, is that we, as a people, had to have a beginning and end to something. Okay? Now, in the Wiccan tradition, or at least the Sayax Wiccan tradition, the time from Samhain to Beltane is called the dark half of the year. Because what happens is that it encompasses the winter and the spring. All right. During winter, the days are shorter, the nights are longer, it's cold, and you don't have as much sun striking the ground and causing things to grow. Okay, so that's why you have, so you're dependent upon the herds and you're dependent upon the wild things to support yourself. You have time of sitting around the house when you can't do anything outside because it's either too cold or there's not enough light. Because back in the, you know, ooze, you didn't have enough candles to light up your field so that you could go work at 2 at night. Okay, so all you could do is sit around the house and knit something. In spring, everything is just starting to come back. The sunshine is just starting to come back, but it's still really, really cold, so the ground is still frozen. You can't plow it. The grass isn't really growing, so you're still having to feed the herds out of your storehouse. And so this is still considered the dark half of the year, even though the light is coming back. All right. Whereas at Beltane, you have an observable time period when everything is growing, everything is going crazy. We have cattle and deer and sheep and everything giving birth. We have heat and light and wonderfulness all over the place. And that continues on around through Samhain, the end of the light half of the year. And this divides the year very neatly into a time period when the god is ascendant and taking care of us, and a time period when the goddess is ascendant and taking care of us. Okay? So that's the basics on the wheel of the year and how I think they developed. Now, you're not going to find any scholar out there who's going to agree with me, because I think this is a unique theory. The different traditions that came up on the various holidays are there because that's what they were able to decide. As Brian mentioned, yes, it's the time, Imbolc is the time when you have the herds starting to get into milk because they are giving birth right around then, at least the domestic herds are. Okay, the wild animals out there aren't really giving birth and getting into rut until around Lusnada. Okay, which is the opposite time of the year. And they're actually giving birth to their children at Samhain so that, you know, they're at least... That one never made sense to me. I mean, here you have a brand new infant who's stumbling around, can't take care of itself, but you're giving birth to it right before the worst part of the year. So that one never made sense to me, at least for the herd animals.
Well, I kind of wonder, though, because... Like, hunting season is the early autumn, And that's sort of the rutting season for a lot of, like, deer and that sort of thing. So I'm wondering if maybe that's the season when they're, like, sort of competing for the right to, you know, seed.
The right to breed.
Offspring. Mm.
There was a line in the Big Blue Book that Buckland was talking about at one point where on the Wheel of the Year, one pole was where the domesticated animals were giving birth, and on the opposite one is where the wild animals were giving birth. So it could be, I'm thinking, Beltane and Samhain, because that would make sense. You have the domestic herds getting pregnant and having sex and everything right around now, around Imbolc and in milk. And they would be giving birth right around Beltane, given about a three or four month gestation period. And the same thing with the wild herds. If they're doing the rut and breeding at Lusnada, they'd be giving birth somewhere around Samhain. I don't know, though. Anyway, so...
I don't know. I don't pay that much attention to animal breeding.
True. I'm sure we're going to get somebody write to us and go, well, you're messed up. And please, understand something. This is simply what we...
This is just speculation, mostly. And free association and I don't know... Don't take every word we say as holy writ, for fuck's sake, seriously.
Please, do your own research. I mean, that's why we have Mary. She's normally here. She's not today. She's at work, who is researching for me and correcting me. But this is what we have come to through my 22 years of practice, Brian's 20 years of practice, and what we've understood from multiple sources, okay? And we don't have photographic memories, so we can't go, okay, this author said such and so at this, okay? We don't have a script for these things that's been researched out and vetted by a group
it's
of
true.
People. I'm doing this staring at my computer screen. Brian is staring at his computer screen. We're on Skype. We're just, you know, basically riffing and doing this from memory, okay? So if we make a mistake or if we say something inaccurate, understand that it is not deliberate and that we will correct ourselves if corrected and given good information. If you have a question, if you have a question of something that we say, do your own research. You know, we are not the be-all, end-all of everything. We just happen to know a little bit more.
And here's a random thought that comes to mind as you say that, too. Mark 7:3 says, why are you looking at the speck of dust in your brother's eye when there's a plank in your own? You should look at... Sorry, it came to mind because someone messaged me about it.
Oh, man. Yes, remove the mote from your own eye before you remove the beam from mine. It's like, okay. Yeah, so if you're not researching or whatever, however, opposite.
Reverse of it. Yeah, something like that. But anyway, you get the picture.
If you're not doing research, try to not call us out about it. And we're, you know, absolutely open with the fact that we don't know everything. We don't even know most things. It's just we've done a lot of reading and speculation, and it's sort of congealed into this pie of magical musings. And this relates back to tarot because...
Everything does at some point in some way.
So, now that we've gotten that basic idea out of the way, the cycle of the holidays, let's talk about Imbolc itself, okay? One of the reasons that I went through all of this is because my studies in Saxwicca, Imbolc was one of those holidays that always struck me as absolutely useless, okay? Here's why. The ritual for the Saxwiccan Imbolc ceremony has... the priest taking up a phallic wand, which literally is a wand that has a tip that is shaped as a penis, okay? And holding it up, and everybody in the coven celebrates. They send all this energy into the wand that represents the god's penis, and then he sets it down on the altar, and the priestess takes up a bowl of soil. He pulls out his athame, digs a hole, sticks a seed into the ground, covers it up, and everybody celebrates. Okay? Now, those of you who have more than a few years under your belt probably recognize the symbolism there, symbology, the namiology, whatever. sorry, it was a reference to Boondock Saints. Symbolism there is that you have a male phallic symbol that you put energy into, and then you use that to create a hole in the earth into which you literally plant a seed. Okay, now if this isn't a graphic representation of a sex act, I have no earthly idea what is. We were talking about the Great Rite in another episode. This is the Sax Wiccans version of the Great Rite. Okay, it is a celebration to bring fertility back to the fields. The reason that I say that this one never made sense to me is because you have a phallic symbol in the phallic wand. You put all of this energy into it. You celebrate. You kiss it. You run around. Everybody's celebrating and holding it and blessing it. And this is a wonderful thing. And then you set it down on the altar and ignore it for the rest of the ceremony. It's like...
Interesting.
Don't you love that?
Reminds me of the phallus in... satanic ritual.
Possibly. But then you take out an edged weapon and you dig a hole in the ground and you literally put a seed into the ground and, you know, impregnate the earth with something that has nothing to do with the...
all the energy you just raised with the penis stick.
Exactly.
It doesn't make any sense to me at all.
No. So I rewrote the ritual a little bit that you ignore the athame and you use the phallic wand to dig the hole. Okay? Penis going into mother's vagina, all the energy going from the phallic wand into the ground for the fertility of the ground. Okay?
That makes a lot more sense.
Putting the seed into the ground to grow and be there for Beltania. Okay? So this is the this was the celebration of Imbolc, and I think it makes a hell of a lot more sense than a lot of them that I've seen. Okay, especially I've seen the Gardnerian one, which is, you know, dancing around and celebrating and leaping through the fire and fivefold kiss, and has nothing to do with the celebration of the ground or the fertility. And it's like, okay.
In Obod, I mean, the whole focus is on the goddess as kind of the mother and, you know, on the whole idea of motherhood and whatnot. And I always thought it would be kind of cool to do, like, sort of midwife-oriented rituals or, you know, like, things related to motherhood and kind of the passage rite from, you know, girlhood to motherhood and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of things that can fit in here. There's a whole mythology around Breed that occurs around this time. There's Groundhog Day, which actually does work for this time period as well, and we'll get to those in a little bit later in the episode. But the main thrust, if you'll forgive the pun, of this ritual and ceremony and this time period is it's midway between through the god's journey of ascendancy. Okay, he took over at Samhain. His wife went to sleep at Yule because she needs rest. God knows she's been up and working all of the light half of the year and she's tired. So he's, you know, been without her for about a month and a half. I'm sure he's very horny and he's, you know, he's running out of energy. He's getting tired. This is the worship ceremony with the god is raising energy and giving it to the Lord so that he is re-energized, so that he can carry us through the rest of the dark half of the year through till Beltania, okay, so that he can make it until his wife wakes up at Ostara, so that he can continue to provide for us as any good father would. All right, so, I mean, somebody goes out and he hunts for 6 hours a day. He doesn't want to get up and go out and hunt 6 hours tomorrow again. But, you know, if he wants food on the table for his family, he's got to. So the idea is to thank him with reverence, with blessings, with energy, to give back to him so that he will be able to continue on and to continue to take care of us. Okay, that tends to be one of the themes for this time of the year. And it's something that I've seen over and over and over in a lot of non-Wiccan traditions. When you break out the symbolism and the people and the words and such and bring it back down to its basic elements. Samhain is the transition from light half to dark half, the transition from the ascendancy of the mother to the ascendancy of the father. Imbolc is the celebration and the thanking of the father, the giving him of energy, showering him with kisses and gifts. Beltane is the opposite of Samhain, the transition, ascendancy, god to goddess, and Lusnada is the celebration of the mother. Okay? So you have those polar opposites wobbling on each other. And it's once again another cycle that goes around. Now, go ahead, Brian. I know you're wanting to jump in with all the symbolism you've been studying for Imbolc or Olmec or whatever you want to call it.
I don't really have that much to add. I mean, it's basically kind of, you know, the whole idea is that it's built around the agrarian cycle of the year, like most things are with the pagan wheel. So, yeah, I mean, it's all about motherhood and that sort of thing. Now, one of the things I was kind of thinking that we could do is, because there are bound to be people who aren't necessarily out of the broom closet or perhaps aren't really feeling the vibe of doing a ritual for themselves, but rather, you know, they want to recognize the holiday in some kind of solitary informal way, or, you know, enhance their celebration, you know, give something else besides ritual. And so I was kind of thinking that maybe we might offer some suggestions as to activities that relate to themes associated with it. And one that comes to mind, because this is, I almost want to credit the Catholic Church with either borrowing it or inspiring it, but February 1st is the Catholic celebration of Candlemas. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, it's about, you know, the idea of light, since the sun is returning and so on. So the two things that come immediately to mind are the idea of either attending a Catholic, you know, mass for Candlemas, which apparently, as I understand it, is a time when they actually bless candles that you would, you know, then take home. Like, I think the idea is you bring your own candles, have them blessed, and then bring them home, and they're supposed to provide blessings, something like that, in the house for the year.
It's when they make the holy water for the year.
I wouldn't doubt that at all. Yeah, so, I mean, there's that. But then there's also the idea of having a bath with floating candles and, you know, kind of just celebrating that. You might want to, you know, treat a mother in your life to dinner, or, you know, somehow recognize the motherhood aspect. Maybe even celebrate your sexuality. I don't know. I mean,
ran out of things already.
Well, I mean, some of the stuff that's suggested by other people is like the idea of drinking fresh spring water all day, because I assume the association there is with the melting of the snow, you know, from winter.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, springs run over, glacier waters are plentiful, which, you know, comes to mind, actually, like, you could take a trip to a local glacier or, you know, to a wild place that has a glacier-fed creek or river, you know, take yourself out there and immerse yourself in icy, cold water. And then that leads me into thinking about this thing that, that native spirituality sort of celebrates, at least out this direction in the world, is the idea of immersing yourself full body into a cold, flowing body of water with, like, handfuls of brush that you then sort of whip yourself with to get, you know, your blood circulating and that sort of thing.
Sounds like a Scandinavian sauna.
It's probably common throughout the world, actually. It wouldn't surprise me in the least. And it does make sense. I mean, you know, if you happen to be in Northern Europe, you know, it's the time of year that you're dealing with the same kind of thing. So a sauna this time of year would be great.
And just as a point, I'm not going to say that ancient man was filthy, because they probably weren't. But you also got to remember that living in northern climes, Scandinavia, even Scotland, Iceland, Greenland, up in that area where a lot of these traditions come from, you don't want to take a bath. There's no way to heat enough water to take a bath and cleanse yourself during the winter. So you pretty much live in your furs and your clothes and stuff. After 2, 3, 4 months of doing this, you get kind of rank. So this is the first opportunity they have to cleanse themselves. And it is a ritual cleansing. That's part of what the sauna is. That's part of what the going and jumping into the free-flowing, ice-cold glacier runoff is. It's getting
clean. Part of
clean.
What a sweat lodge is about, too.
Mm-hmm. It's getting clean. It's getting all this poison and everything out of your system, and then getting it off of your body. Okay, so there's all of that too. So, you know, it's a good time to do a ritual cleaning. And hey, there's an association with spring cleaning too. Cleanse your house as well at the same time. You know,
that's true.
That's another tradition that you can do. Here's the thing that I kind of figured out with the groundhog. If you think about the fire festivals, every single fire festival has an association with divination with it, okay? Centuries ago, when modern man did not have satellites, or when mankind didn't have satellites,
No such time existed.
It did back in the 1200s and before, really. Well, okay, there was one satellite.
Always had a satellite.
That's right. It was the moon. The moon was the satellite, but we had no man-made satellites. No GPS location, no weather satellites or communication satellites or anything like that. Okay? We had simply what we could observe of nature as a weather predictor. So people were actually paying attention to the various things around them. Did you know that you could tell the weather by how high the ducks are flying? Because the ducks are going to fly at a certain level where there is X amount of pressure in the atmosphere, okay? So if they're flying low, that means that there's a very high pressure area in the area, and that means that there's going to be, you know, good weather when they're flying low, because they're hitting that equilibrium where they're comfortable at for the long distance flying. And when farmers see that and they're low in the sky, that means, from having observed, that there's going to be good weather for the next few days. Okay, if they're flying very high in the sky, they're still hitting that equilibrium area that they need to be in for efficient flight, but this is a low pressure area in the air in where they're flying at. So they're hitting that area that they need to be in, but the farmer seeing that knows that there's going to be rain in the next couple of days. Okay? So this is where the weather witching comes from, and being able to see, you know, how things are going to be based on how the animals around you are reacting. The groundhog came about because, just like watching where the ducks are flying when they're migrating, or how thick the spider's building its web, or if the coat on the sheep is especially thin this year, or where the ants are, you know, foraging at, they noticed that if the groundhog comes out and sees his shadow, that there's going to be bad weather in a few weeks. Okay, 6 more weeks of winter. Okay, which incidentally pushes it out to Ostara. Okay, so that means that if the groundhog comes out and sees a shadow, what does that mean? It means that there's no cloud cover in the sky and it's a sunny day. Well, right around this time period, what you have is this transition from winter to summer, or winter to spring. So, and just like the transition from the Pacific to the Atlantic Ocean off the southern cape of South America is a really turbulent area, because you have two massively huge systems that are trying to combine and don't really do it well, you have these two different types of weather, this very cold air mass being pushed out by this warm air mass, you get a turbulent weather time period in the spring, at right around Imbolc. So if the groundhog comes out and he sees a shadow, that means there's no clouds in the sky. Well, that means that that turbulent weather that's supposed to be there is being put off for a couple of weeks, and you really shouldn't take your beans out yet. However, if the groundhog comes out and doesn't see a shadow, that means there's clouds in the sky, and that means right around now is when that turbulent weather is going to start hitting hard. And so you should keep your beans in. But then on the backside of it, once that weather pushes through, spring is going to start springing. And you're not going to have the bad weather of winter for another 6 weeks. It's another means of divination and weather witching by using the observable animals around them. And this is a piece of UPG, but it makes sense given that the weather patterns around the time period, we know what they are, given that you can understand how animals act and react given environments that they're in. Because if you think about it, we've got groundhogs in Pennsylvania and in Georgia and in Minnesota and in California that all say different things. Well, you know what? They're only predicting the weather for their little regional area. I really wouldn't expect a groundhog who sees his shadow on the other side of the planet to be able to accurately predict what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks for me.
Exactly.
So that's my theory of Groundhog Day. But it's another divination, just like you have divinations at Beltane, just like you have them at Samhain, and just like you have them at Luznada. So it's another version of the same celebration. So divinations are a good thing to do at this time period, too.
I think they're good at any of the festivals, really. I mean, they're points of power and, you know, points where people are looking for insights. And actually, they're a good time, too, to start sort of contemplating maybe taking up the habit of wildcrafting or just even basically getting to know the plants in your area. Because as pagans, I think one of the things that we want to do is not only to investigate and study the things that sort of make the spiritual paths that we particularly follow, but also take the time to build a relationship with the land that we live on. Because a lot of people, especially in this modern day, are so caught up with the hurly-burly of daily life that, you know, they never think about the land that, you know, they walk on, that, you know, humans have perhaps walked on thousands and thousands of years. And part of building a relationship with the landscape is to get familiar with the inhabitants of it. So, you know, if plants aren't your thing, then, you know, maybe go bird watching. Take up, I don't know, squirrel watching or something. You know, just find yourself something that you enjoy that allows you to connect with the landscape. You know, even sitting in your local park, don't feed the ducks. That's actually not good for them.
No.
Yeah, old people, you smack the bag out of their hand and say, no! And move on.
Kind of like the pigeons, but yeah.
That's true.
Anyway, yeah, feeding ducks in public like that makes them dependent upon people for their food. They stop teaching other generations of the ducks how to fend and forage for themselves. They also lose their fear of people. I don't know if you've ever seen a duck attack a human being, but they do it all the time. And you're talking about 110 pound of goose in the size of a cocker spaniel who comes running up and attacks a child that weighs probably half of it because they want food. And the child gets injured. This is not a good thing to do. Also, nutritionally, it's probably one of the worst things you could do. You might as well just go out and toss some arsenic because that would be kinder. They're getting no calories, they're getting no kind of nutrition, and they're starving to death even though they're eating all the time. So, we're going to have probably eventually Lupa on the show to talk to us about all of this, about the animals. She is a huge advocate for responsible use of animals, not only in crafts and animal husbandry, but they're waste products. A lot of people would consider them after they're dead, the skins and bones and antlers and such.
True.
So we'll talk to her about all of that when we have her on the show. She's a friend of mine. She's a friend of Brian's.
She's actually great. We've had her on, like, before we had Tarot Talk and Magical Musings, actually. I had her for an episode of the podcast series that I was doing as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to check out Woodwost Radio and Blog Talk Radio, you can find that episode. I don't happen to have it memorized and as to how, like, when we did it, but nonetheless, she was on there.
I her wasn't part actually, of this.
No, this was actually before. I think it was her that introduced me to you, actually.
You had advertised on Tumblr for somebody to do a tarot podcast with you, and I think I was the only one that answered.
There was that, too. Well, I mean, I had people answering, but not people who were, like, long-time tarot readers. Like, I don't want amateurs, you know.
I started reading tarot last week. I'll do it with you.
Well, that's just it. That's the kind of people I was getting. I was like, wait a minute. I don't need someone who's been reading them a month and who's just kind of like, I make it up as I go. What? Okay, partly that's useful, but don't rely on just your own random interpretations, because I could do that. I mean, I could call myself an astrologer, you know, if I'm just going to make shit up. You know, like, be realistic here.
And then you had this very weird woman come up and say, hey, I've been reading tarot for 20 years, and I know damn near everything there is to know about it, and I'm an arrogant shit, so let's do it.
I was totally down with that. I like the vibe of this. And hell, I mean, obviously something worked out, because we're still doing a series together.
Yes, and with 16 tarot talks, and then one Magical Monday, and then 11 of these, so 11, 12, and 16 is 28 episodes that we've done together. That's you know, a year's worth of stuff right there.
It very much is. That was totally like a tangent that I wasn't planning on. I was going to say, folks, her name is spelled Lupa. Look her up on Amazon. Buy her books. We totally recommend them because I find them fascinating myself. And what she's got new ones out. She's probably working on others.
And she's a fantastic person. I've known her for about 10 years now. Some of her books are really, really good. She's a psychologist, I want to say, a clinical psychologist
in real life. Yeah.
I know that she does something with mental health. I don't know if it's psychiatry or psychology. I think it's psychology.
Sounds right.
You know, but she's so she knows her. She's got chops. She knows her stuff.
It's true. And you can find her on Tumblr, too, at thegreenwolf.tumblr.com.
Yes, she's wonderful.
That's right, plugging the shit out of Lupa, because we want her on the show.
I've got just about all of her books here, with very few exceptions. She flattered the hell out of me not too long ago. She sent me a copy of one of her books, New Paths to Animal Totems, and I'm reading through it.
I want to read that one.
She told me when she sent it, I said, look, I can't do a review of it because I've been reviewing her books for a long time and putting them up on Aaron's Journal. And she said, no, you don't have to review it. You don't have to plug it for me. I just want your opinion on it because I really value your opinion. And I was like, oh, that is so sweet. And it was really, really flattering because it's like, wow, cool. Anyway. So, okay, back to symbolic. Okay, so the first...
By the way, while we're plugging authors we want to have on the show, look up Galina Kraskova. She's like this, you know, rebellious author who's kind of got a reputation for stirring the shit. So, you know...
She was a riot when she was on here.
She's... fun. Oh, my God. Great. I want her on the show again.
We were talking about the Northern Tradition. She was our guest host. And she said, okay, well, this is the Northern Tradition. And that took about a half an hour. And the rest of the show was riffing on everything else in wonderful, magical musings tradition.
It's true.
We went off on tangents.
We could have gone so much farther, too. It's just time limits constrained us on that one.
And you would think that a two-hour time limit wouldn't be that hard, but, you know, when you're talking about 2 hours talking about everything that comes to mind and voicing your opinions on something, one of the things... No, seriously, everybody listening... This show is special to me and special to Brian, mainly due to the fact that this is our opportunity to get information that people have been begging for decades out there into the community, okay? What you get, and we've said this before, what you get from most of the teachers, most of the classes, most of the books, most of the chats, most of the YouTube videos is the same regurgitated, recycled stuff that's out there, that's been out there. And there's only so many times that you can sit down and listen to something about how to build an altar before you go, okay, I got these. These are the basic concepts. Yes, you can make it out of a pine wood derby box or and a door and bless it and carve things on it. That's great. Why do we have an altar? Why do we need an altar? Which nobody answers. That's what we're trying to do here. We are trying to answer those questions that we came up with while we were searching. And once we got past the basic stuff, and started looking deeper into it and figuring out what was going on and why it was there. That's why we jump into things like what the hell Groundhog Day has to do with Imbolc. Why,
or tarot, for that matter.
Or tarot, exactly. Explaining the Wheel of the Year. This is why we do this, so that you have more information and can continue it on for the decades in the future, from there to the 301 stuff and teach a new generation of pagans. And then they can go into the 401 stuff and maybe one day mankind who has studied this stuff and who has really looked into their psyche can go, okay, we are the same people. We have different skin colors. We live in different regions, but we all want the same basic things. Here's how we do it.
It's
okay.
True.
End of the screed.
Kitty, enough.
As several people in the past, from Native American shaman to modern day yogis to the Dalai Lama to other people in various groups to the Pope, have said, if all we do is keep retreading the same ground, we never get anywhere. So we're trying to advance that ground. There are a few books out there that do this, not many, because they don't sell. So, okay.
True. I mean, there's not enough market for books that, because by the time you've gotten into any pagan path for a few years, you kind of figure, you know, you figure stuff out yourself, you find resources, so you don't want to buy a book that's trying to tell you stuff you might already know.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, okay. End of... back to the holiday. I hate it when we do this. I really do, but I love it, but I hate it, but I love it.
I think that's what makes our show what it is. I mean, I don't know how many listeners there are, because... I don't know, guys. You never actually talk to us.
Yeah, we only have the one,
you know,
so far.
Like, it's true, and we appreciate that. So, you know, you want to hit us up at all, Brian or Joy at magicalmusings.net. You know, mm-hmm. you found the website this, you know, like this. It's
or if you found us
that,
yeah. Or if you found us through Amazon, like she did. We're at magicalmusings.net. Please come.
Oh, weird, Amazon.
There's
Amazon
more
is so
there.
Interesting in the U.S.
Mm. Or not Amazon, iTunes. iTunes.
Oh, I was going to say. Wow. Sophisticated as fuck.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, iTunes is great stuff.
Yes, iTunes is great. We have all the shows up there now, so you can subscribe to the podcast. Here we go, plugging everything again.
That's okay. We need a few minutes of filler.
Brian at magicalmusings.net, Joy at magicalmusings.net, Brian is cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com, I am wide-worlds, no apostrophe, just worlds as in multiple worlds, -joy.tumblr.com. I have my own major website called Aaron's Journal. That is at aaronsjournal.com, E-R-I-N-S-J-O-U-R-N-A-L. I'm sure Brian has one.
Not really.
Not really?
I mean, if you want to hit me up on Blog Talk Radio, you could always follow. It's the address is blogtalkradio.com/woodwose, W-O-O-D-W-O-S-E. You'll find some of the older episodes of Magical Musings. You'll find all the tarot talk. You'll find some other random podcasts that I did, and you'll find the one on barefoot living that I happen to have enjoyed a great deal. Mm. Talked to an author, talked to a couple other guys, and we had kind of a roundtable discussion on it. But nonetheless, I mean, plugging the crap out of everything.
Yeah, well, you know, every single blogcast out there, podcast, website, whatever, the idea is to get listeners, and they do that by plugging stuff, and the overall goal is to make money. Well, you know, we'd like to make money, too. The thing is that we're not doing it by selling anything through our podcast. We're doing it by connecting with you, the listeners, and asking for donations to help us keep going. If this was of any value to you, please come to magicalmusings.net. There is a donate button right on the main page and on every single subsequent page. $5 would not be amiss. We do have expenses. We're paying for all of this out of our own pocket. We're not making any money through iTunes because we're not charging for the for the podcast. So you want us to keep going? You want to tell us we're doing a wonderful job? Hey, there you go. There's a great way to do it.
You want to criticize us? Send us messages. You know, we
yeah.
want to hear about what we're doing right, what we're not doing. If there's something that comes to mind, a question you've had on your own, you know, uncertain walk on any pagan path, I've explored a bunch of them myself. Joy's familiar with a lot of different stuff, too. You know, if there's a question you have on, like, Hellenic Reconstructionism, we might be able to answer it.
And if we can't, we can always get Cianon on here.
That's true. I mean, there's plenty of alternative, like, paths that we, you know, could answer questions about. I mean, I happen to consider myself a hedge druid. Joy considers herself, I don't know, Wiccan.
A Wiccan druid witch.
Fair enough. And actually, I had someone recently ask me what a hedge druid was. So, in vague terms, it's someone who basically makes up his own path. I do use Obod's material and kind of loose ritual inspiration, shall we say. But my own path actually unfolded through, you know, a childhood interest in, you know, Stone Age cultures and native spirituality, etc., and it unfolded from there, you know, into neo-paganism and that sort of thing. So,
and my path unfolded from a grandmother who was very into New Age Christian mysticism and sort of flowed from there through the Mormon Church into agnosticism and finally into Wicca as what I've been practicing my whole life. And between the two of us, Brian and I both, we have a fairly wide network of friends and a fairly deep penetration into most of the pagan paths that are out there currently. I've corresponded with the head of ADF, all three of the Archdruids, including Isaac Bonowitz in the past. Buckland knows who I am, and he's the founder of Stax Wicca. We've got people in Discordia. We've got people in just about anything that you could possibly name that's a pagan classification, mainly because we're on a lot of boards. We made contacts. We've stayed in touch with them. We respect their opinion. They respect ours, and we share our information with each other. So if we don't know it, we can either research it and find it, or we know somebody who does know it, or we know somebody who knows somebody who does know it.
We'll gladly have, you know, guests on the show to cover specific topics of interest.
Oh, Lord, yes.
Even if they're not, you know, strictly part of, say, Wicca or Druidry or whatever, basically because they're fascinating. And, mm-hmm. and the more you know, the better off your path will be, because you'll be able to either incorporate new things or perhaps find a path that's better suited to you, mm-hmm. because let's face it, not everyone wants to be Wiccan. I know that's heresy, and I know all the Wiccans out there are going to like strike me down with magic, but seriously, not everyone wants to be Wiccan, and not everyone wants to be a druid, and so on. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's paths out there. You just got to find them.
And then there are controversial paths that people, you know, hear about and go, oh, my God. Like Kirk Culain. I'm studying with him currently. He has a magical warrior, the Path of the Paladins.
Interesting.
That has started out. He started it with the Wiccan warrior and has continued it through magic combat. I know it's a book. Yeah, I don't remember the book right off the top of my head either. But he's got like four books in this series where he details a warrior's philosophy inside of Wicca that works and works really, really well. So, you know, there's a lot of paths out there that a lot of people don't know about, that need their own publicity, because I don't know about you, but celebrating the female is great and fantastic and wonderful, but there's very little celebration of the male out there, and there's very
That's
little
true.
Celebration of the warrior out there. But these are just as valid as the mother and crone versions of Wicca and paganism. And there needs to be a celebration of the person that puts himself or herself between the universe of anger and fear and hate and destruction and the people that they love. There needs to be a celebration sure. of that. And the mother doesn't do that. The mother cares and nurtures.
A mother bear will kick your ass if you get between her and a cub. But
yeah, but as a last resort.
That's true. I do kind of wonder if we shouldn't have Kara Culain and Terry Riley on a show sometime, like either alone or together as part of a roundtable discussion where we can discuss those kind of things. I mean, mm-hmm. the significance of the male aspect of paganism and spirituality in general, because it's not like, the idea that comes to mind with a lot of people is that the male spirituality is purely and strictly the patriarchal monotheistic religions that we've come to, you know,
understand.
That have basically
yeah.
been, yeah, that are basically like the religions that people think of when they think of male spirituality. But there's an aspect of paganism that isn't strictly goddess focused, and you know, the balance between male and female has to be addressed by a recognition and celebration of not only the female, but the male as well. And it doesn't mean that you dislike women or that you're misogynistic or that you're patriarchal or anything like that. These concepts exist out there, and there are certainly, you know, fundamentalist pagans out there who, you know, who are all about the male and so on and so forth. But ultimately, there is kind of a neglect of the male aspect of divinity. So I kind of think that maybe in the future, one of our shows, at least, should address the god or male spirituality and various forms that it takes, or, you know, things
when,
like that.
Yeah, and when you stop and if you look at the pagan community as a whole and look at the various gathering places for paganism, Heartland, the various bookstores and things like that, you're going to notice that there's always a class or a workshop or something or a spontaneous gathering of male drumming circles and male get together, and we're going to talk about male issues, okay? Because this is a screaming need. It's something that has fundamentally changed the face of the world, in that male patriarchy has been presented as this by, I'm going to say it, the Christian church, the Jewish faith, the Muslim faith, by a lot of worldwide faiths, that a man has to be strong, that a man has to defend, that a man can't cry, that a man can't be sensitive, that a man can't be nurturing, that the man can't love. And they have to be the breadwinner and go out and kill themselves and sacrifice themselves for the female. And now there's this backlash of all these men who are going, wait a minute, I enjoy taking care of children. I enjoy loving my wife. I enjoy being tender. Why can't we celebrate that? And you always see it in New Age shops, in the gathering places for paganism, because we not only acknowledge that and acknowledge the feminine parts of male psyche, but we give them an outlet for it. But it's still not common, and there's still a lot of people out there in the pagan community that are perpetuating the same damn thing that they've been fed all their lives by all these other major religions, that a man has to be strong, that a woman is the only one that can be nurturing and loving. And that's complete junk. So, yeah, I think we are going to have some shows in the future about the male aspects. And we're doing it now because this ties back into the celebration of the man and Imbolc. So, hey, here we go, full circle with our ramblings once again.
It's true. We can always do that.
Oh, man.
We may go off on tangents like nobody's business, but we'll get back to what we're talking about.
We will. Now, in opposition to what we've just been saying for the last 20 minutes about the male and about this celebration being for the male, Brian is very right. There's a lot of the female in it, too. Imbolc and Olmec and all of those around this time period are also a celebration of the goddess Breed, B-R-I-G-I-D, Bridget, Saint Breed, Saint Bride, however you want to pronounce her. She is a major section of this time period as well. Now, I don't know how many people know a lot about Breed, so we're going to hit her mythology very quickly here. She is the goddess of newlyweds and crafters. Her association in a lot of cases is with fire, the hearth, and home. So you have a time around here that is also the new feminine, starting a new life, but you also have her being a blacksmith. There is another divinatory practice that you can practice right around now where young maidens will look in the hearth fire to see if there's any omens in the ashes and the coals as to who they're going to marry and who they're going to be with. And that is literally called Bridget's Bed, I believe. I read this a while ago, so I may be really off on
this.
I know for a fact that it has something to do with Bridget. It has something to do with the hearth and the fire. And it's a divinatory practice. I'm not sure if it's for young maidens. Well, I tell you what. Why don't we just do the smart thing and what Mary normally does and look it up? No.
You're crazy.
Oh, goodness. Looking something up.
Rather than speculating randomly and guessing at it, that's just silly.
Mm.
You're supposed to ramble and assume.
All right. Let's see. Bridget's
it's
Bed.
It's true. We do this.
Yeah. We randomly speculate and talk around and fill silence with dumb things. And that's how a lot of our... A lot of our speculation and rambling came about originally. Okay, on Google there is
I suppose that's true.
A lot of information about Bridget's Bed. And there, hey, look, embolic on Wikipedia. What do you know? Trying to pull stuff up and
crazy.
It's been forever. But okay.
Wikipedia has things?
Information on it, lots of information. It's insane. One of also the traditions is to make a Bridget's cross, which if you've seen the four-armed sun wheel made of straw that's folded over each other, that
that's
is
funny. I just reblogged one.
Really? Outstanding.
I did. I was just looking it up and on Tumblr, and I reblogged it right now.
Funny. No, it's a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful craft thing. And it's an equal armed cross, very Celtic in nature, which is understandable. Which is, easily made, and it's, you know, a sun wheel. It's got, I can't believe I'm about to say this, there is an association because it looks similar to, a swastika. Even though it doesn't have the canted down arms, it's an offset wheel, like a swastika is. Okay, and it's a wonderful project. It's her symbol. It's usually made of straw for decorations and stuff. But let's see, Saint Bridget, Christianized Bridget. Here we go. Embolic strongly associated with Saint Breed. That is on Catholicism. Breed was said to visit virtuous households and bless the inhabitants as they slept. As Breed represented the light half of the year and the power that will bring people from the dark season of winter into spring, her presence was very important to this time of the year. In the 19th century, families would have a supper on Embolic Eve and mark the end of winter. Often some of the food and drink would be set aside for Breed. Before going to bed, items of clothing or strips of cloth would be left outside for Breed to bless. Ashes from the fire would be raked smooth, and in the morning they would look for some kind of mark on the ashes as a sign that Breed had visited. So I was remembering correctly.
That's good.
Yes, it's always very good. Anyway... So she's associated with this time period, and if you think about it, we're also in midpoint of the light, the dark half of the year, when the season, the days are short, you don't have a lot of time to do anything outside, so you're doing things that are needed to be done inside where it's warm. And one of those things would be making crafts in the forge for the coming year, sharpening your axes and making a plowshare and everything like that. So there's another association with her and with fire at the same time as well. Let's see, in Ireland and Scotland, girls and young women would make a breed log, a doll-like figure of breed made from rushes and reeds. It would be clad in bits of cloth, shells, and flowers. In the Hebrides, girls would carry it in a procession while singing a hymn to breed. They all wore white with their hair unbound as a symbol of purity and youth. So there's the child connection. Breed's crosses were made at Imbolc. Breed's cross consists of rushes woven into the shape similar to a swastika. Oh my god. With a square in the middle and four arms projecting from each corner. They were often hung over doors, windows, and stables welcoming Breed and to protect the buildings from fire and lightning. The crosses were generally left there until the next Imbolc. In Western Connacht, which is one of the provinces of Ireland, that's on the western half of Ireland, people would make a creole breed, a great ring of rushes with a cross woven in the middle. The young boys would carry it around the village, inviting people to step through it and so be blessed. Weather divination, and hey, here's the association with Groundhog Day. Wow. Neo-paganism. Celtic Reconstructionist, Wicca. Oh, which reminds me, there is a wonderful article that I have to find by Mike Nichols, who, if you are ever curious about untalked about aspects of each of the eight Sabbaths of Wicca and paganism, go find them, read them. They are outstanding. They were written back in the 70s by a gentleman who had a pagan bookstore up in the north central section of the United States. I want to say in Minnesota, Michigan, but I don't think that's right. And they've been circulating around the internet and around pagan circles for decades. A lot of people pull the information out and drop the credit to him, but if you ever see an article that is by him, read it. They're really deep, they're really insightful, and they're extremely good. Do you know the ones I'm talking about, Brian?
The name sounds familiar. I've probably encountered a couple of his articles over the years.
Okay. There was one that he did, it was one of the first ones for Samhain that I had ever seen that actually went in and described in depth some of the symbolism. There's one that I'm thinking about with Lusnada and Luslachifis and Gorwin Pevir and the cycle between those two deities of the light and the dark half with Bloodwet and their eternal cycle and the symbolism that's in that story. Let me find his article real quick. Oh, Kerr's online. Cool. Because it's just, it's one of those outstanding items that everybody needs to know about. Let's see. Imbolc. Imbolc.
Well done.
I can spell. Hey, what do you know? Also realize something. The names of the holidays are mostly from the Celtic Reconstruction. So the names,
the Irish too.
Yeah. So the names are going to change, and when they do, don't be distressed. Okay, just learn the new names and move on. This one that he wrote on Imbolc is called Candlemas: The Light Returns. Candlemas is the Christianized name for the holiday, of course. The older pagan names were Imbolc and Oimelc. Embolic means literally in the belly of the mother. For the womb is Mother Earth, hidden from the mundane sight, but sensed by the keener vision, there are stirrings. Let's see. Holiday is also called Bridget's Day in honor of the great Irish goddess Bridget. The Roman Catholic Church could not very easily call the great goddess of Ireland a demon, so they canonized her instead. Henceforth, she would be known as Saint Breed, patron saint of smithcraft, poetry, and healing. They explained this by telling the Irish peasants that Breed was really an early Christian missionary sent to the Emerald Isle, and that the miracles she performed there misled the common people into believing that she was a goddess. For some reason, the Irish swallowed this whole. Gee.
Interesting.
When you have somebody with a sword at your throat saying, you're going to believe this, and this is what it is, you kind of tend to go, well, okay. Not a problem.
Well, I mean, unless you've decided that you're going to give your life for some belief or other.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. But yes, I mean, if you're forced to change your attitude about something, sure, you're going to probably do it if your life is threatened.
Oh, there's that too. Groundhog Day is mentioned in this article. Valentine's Day is coming up. And that is also another common holiday associated with this. February 14th is what is St. Valentine's Day. It is a saint's day in the celebration of the Catholic Church. It has become associated with love and romance and everything else, which fits with the young maidens going around looking for a beau, the divination in the fires for Breed, and so forth. It's another association, even though most of the Valentine's Day celebrations have nothing to do with Embolic or Breed herself. Okay. Let's see. There's speculation that amongst linguistic scholars that the very name of Valentine has pagan origins. And that's one of the interesting things. For modern witches, Candlemas may be seen as the pagan version of Valentine's Day, with a de-emphasis of hearts and flowers and the appropriate re-emphasis of pagan carnal frivolity. This also realigns
a nice subtle way of putting it.
This also realigns the holiday with the ancient Roman Lupercalia, a fertility festival held at this time in which the priests of Pan ran throughout the streets of Rome whacking young women with goatskin thongs to make them fertile.
And that's not the kind of thongs that Cisco was singing about. We're talking about leather strings.
Yeah. Imagine a flogger made from goatskin. Okay. I have several of them, and they sting, but they don't really cut or hurt, even though in, like, Saturnalia, the young men are running around with bleeding genitals from doing the same thing.
You have goatskin floggers?
Actually, a couple, yes. Why?
Fascinating. I want one now. It's just so weird.
Well,
so random out of the blue. I have a goatskin flogger. Is that so weird?
Yes, it is very weird. No, seriously, the goatskin that we've got is the super soft, the super thin garment suede is most often goatskin. Okay.
Huh.
It's extremely thinly sliced. It's maybe it's called a half an ounce because one square inch of it weighs a half an ounce. Okay. This is the stuff that they make drawstring bags from. Gloves from. And this is garment class leather. I've got, like I said, a couple, but they're very, very thin. They're very, very light. In BDSM, they would be used to flog a person's nipples as a sense play thing rather than a pain, a pleasure through pain thing response. So, yeah.
Somehow that relates to Invoke, too.
It does. I mean, the goatskin floggers that the priest ran about with. There you go. I mean, think about it. You have a very light piece of leather. It is slapping you on the JJ and on your nipples to make you fertile.
How subtle. Interesting.
Okay. It's not hurting. It's sense play. It can, in the revel that they are going about it with, jumping all over the place, dancing in the streets naked, they probably wouldn't feel it in the moment that it's hitting them. So it really wouldn't do that much, but it's the symbolic thing of the fertility of the goat going into the fertility of the woman to continue life.
Incidentally, this would relate to the whole notion of being accused of satanic rites because of the connection to goats. Because
yes.
Goats are seen as the face of the devil, and you know the fertility and the orgies associated with that festival would have been seen as satanic, orgiastic, sexual perversions.
Well, one person's perversion is another person's pleasure. I mean, I've said it before in other episodes of Tarot Talk and Magical Musings. I'm into BDSM. It's not anything that I'm ashamed of. It is one of those things that brings pleasure to myself and Mary at various points in our life. It is a way to reaffirm a very strong connection between the two of us. We enjoy it. We don't ask anybody else to participate in it, unless you want to. If you're interested, we'll be more than happy to teach and show and, you know, do whatever. Very few times does it actually involve a sex act of penetration or orgasm. Most often it is a way to expiate sin or guilt, get rid of it, a way to reaffirm the trust between spouses and people that care very deeply about each other. It's a way of doing an endurance trip, doing a very deep psyche evaluation, because when you're helpless and you can't get away from something that is striking you with some force on your back, it throws you into a mindset where the only place, if you can't go out, the only place you can go is in. And you really start looking internally and doing what's called flying.
Wasn't it mentioned in the Big Blue Book that flogging was used as a means of altering your state of consciousness?
It was mentioned
Sacred Kink as well.
Yeah, well, Sacred Kink was written specifically for this. I'll get to that in a second. But it was mentioned in the Big Blue Book about the straitjacket swings that they had for sense deprivation.
Witch's Cradle, etc.
Yes, the Witch's Cradle. It's mentioned more in Alexandrian and Gardnerian with the Scourge, to put you into an altered state of consciousness and to get you out of your body. Okay?
Makes sense.
Yeah, the Scourge, for those of you who don't know, is a sacred whip in Alexandrian and Gardnerian Wicca. It consists of 9 thongs that you lightly whip across the other person. The bondage is part of it, and that's one of the reasons that it was speculated that Gardner, who was a known nudist, was also into BDSM and wanted to bring this into his religious practice. There is a purpose for it, though.
That wouldn't surprise me, though, because, I mean, Crowley himself mentions it in some of his writing as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole idea of pain as a means of altering your consciousness, and, I mean, I think Isaac Bonowitz brings it up in some book or other as well.
It probably does. It's a recurring thing.
There's a lot of foundation for the idea.
Mm-hmm. It's a recurring thing. I have to admit, just as an observation, I have met more kinky pagans than I have met more kinky people in the world. It seems like just about everybody that is in paganism has some familiarity with at least the basics of BDSM, even if they don't like it. And there seems to be a lot more active practitioners in the BDSM scenes who are pagan than who are in, you know, the normal day-to-day life.
It's true.
It's, I mean, just one of those things.
It's something that I think you sort of, in your research, you come across it mentioned, and then you kind of go, well, that's sort of interesting, actually, because if that's a means that you can, you know, enhance your spirituality and enhance relationships and, you know, go deeper within yourself, etc., then suddenly it's like, why wouldn't you want to be curious at least, if not get right into exploring it?
Yeah, and I'll be the first to admit, the lifestyle for those who practice it is not something that everybody can do. Most people seem to, in paganism, who are interested in it, are what I call dabblers. They enjoy the idea of it. And then everything gets, you know, related back to embolic because of the, you know, floggers and scourges.
Well, you know what? I think we should really be willing to investigate this, you know, more deeply. I mean, if there are authors and stuff that you know as well who might, like, help you with more of a roundtable type thing, or
Lupa's one of them.
Go all crazy and is she really?
Yes, she is. She and Taylor Elwood co-wrote a book called Kink Magic, which I contributed the bondage spread to as one of the appendixes, which is, talk about it in tarot talk, but it comes from the visualization of a St. Andrew's cross and doing a tarot spread based on that. And it's actually, I think, pretty relevant. And then you mentioned, you know, kink, whatever it was.
No idea.
The other book, just a few minutes ago.
Sacred Kink.
Sacred Kink, that's it.
I'm going to actually pull it off the shelf, because I'm pretty sure I know where it is. Give me a sec.
Okay.
It's by Lee Harrington.
Okay. And
yeah, it's pretty interesting.
And as we, you know, if you do any research into it, there are multiple people and multiple authors who mention it in passing, even if they don't approve of it. It is, you know, one tool in the bag of spiritualism. There's even versions of it in other faiths. And here's, you know, one of the things that shocked the heck out of me is that it appears in Druidism as well. And I was like, yeah. What? Yeah. They throw a Druid into a dark cave. They put a white bullhide leather over top of him. Then they put a 200-pound rock on his belly and seal him in the cave for 8 days.
The Imbas Forosnai, isn't it?
It's a major divinatory ritual, but the thing is that this is a huge, you know, divination celebration. The bull is sacrificed specifically so that they can cut his skin off, tan it, and throw it over a guy in a cave with a rock on him.
Wouldn't appeal to vegans, is what we're saying, but yes.
Everybody, you know, sees this and goes, what the hell? This sounds just terrible. But if you think about it, they're taking away the light. They're taking away the senses. They're taking away the wind. They're taking away the hearing. They're taking away every single sense that he has, and then putting him under this crushing weight for several days where he's expected to go into a meditative trance. And when they come into the cave very quietly and yank all of this stuff off of him, he is supposed to come up out of this trance and immediately start speaking these divinations and these predictions and these omens from the gods, because he's been in sensory deprivation for the last 9 days. This is a major ritual. It's a sacred ritual. And most kink people are going, yeah, give it to me. That sounds great.
Fair enough.
I'm sorry. Anyway.
No, but seriously, I think that we should do a show that focuses on it. Because, I mean, it's something that I was curious about over the years and something that I saw in passing all the time. You know about it. And, I mean, there's people out there who, you know, have written about it. So, I mean,
yeah, we can do
maybe,
that.
maybe sometime in February, like around Valentine's Day. Because, I mean, if you're going to talk about love, you might as well talk about special relationships.
Beat me, whip me, I need love.
Exactly.
Oh, God. I don't know. We've got some shows that are planned. One of the things that I was thinking about doing was pulling down the broadcast calendar because it seems like we can't stick to it. So
that might be an idea. Yeah. I mean, we do sort of come up all random with, hey, let's do this, and, oh, this didn't work out, so let's try this instead.
We had this scheduled for today, but, yeah, so we're going to do this over here.
Exactly.
Anyway.
And it would actually make it better, because, I mean, if we have to schedule certain guests or whatever, then
it would make it a lot more flexible.
Set a schedule for it. Like, okay. Then we can just put it up whenever we have the opportunity.
Okay. So this is the thing, guys. I'm on the website, magicalmusings.net. We're going to pull down the broadcast calendar, and since no one is using it, we're also going to pull down the forum that is available. It's been up there for half a year. Nobody's posted to it except me. So we're just going to get rid of that as well. You can still get in touch with us through the website. We're going to have a list of topics that we will talk about at some time in the future up there, which will be updated, but we're not going to have dates associated with them. Okay? We're just going to have
probably a good idea.
Yeah, upcoming shows at some point when we get around to recording them.
Exactly. And, you know, that way if someone hits us up and, you know, has this brilliant idea of an author they know who might relate to that particular topic, or, you know, they have friends who've been into, I don't know, broom making, besom making, whatever you want to call it, for 8 years, and they, you know, et cetera. I mean, we could, you know, have a show about it.
Mm-hmm. Certainly can. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing that, and, you know, yes, certainly. If y'all have ideas, if you have suggestions, if you know people that would be good for this or for a specific topic that, and I want to qualify this, that actually know their shit. Not the...
That does
the,
help.
Yeah, I mean, somebody that's been doing this for 10 years, you would expect that knows their stuff, and they have good reviews from people in the community who say, yes, they know what they're doing, they know what they're talking about. That's great. We'll include them, we'll talk to them, we'll, you know, make friends with them and everything. But somebody that became the high priestess after 1 month of practice, probably not. Because
yeah, or, you know, through like a 2 month mail order degree program, that might help. You know, there are people out there who do progress quickly, but
it's the
they've only been around 2 months, might not really benefit us. So.
Which relates back to the topic of the day, because last night when I was thinking about what I wanted to say on the show, one of the things that came up was, remember the Wheel of the Year that we came up with? Well, if you look at it and you think about 13 moons, each of 28 days each. That's 364 days. So that's where you get the phrase of a year and a day. You have a year of moons plus 1 day.
Interesting. So technically, the whole idea of that is, you know, just stick with the modern year and you're fine.
Yeah. And the fact that the actual length from full moon is 29 and a quarter days, and it doesn't work out exactly.
Really?
Yeah, it is.
Huh. Fascinating and weird.
Anyway.
That's nature for you. It totally screws with your plan.
Yes, it does. And the moon is getting closer. One day, 100 billion years from now, it's going to crash into the Earth.
When the moon is in the seventh house.
And Jupiter aligns with Mars. Anyhow.
I wonder if that's supposed to happen based on the precession of the zodiac. I'm curious now.
The song itself comes from the idea that over the centuries, the zodiac has been advancing. It's been getting out of sync with the orbit of the Earth. When the zodiac was originally created centuries ago, And they associated, you know, Leo and Virgo and everything. The Romans did this. Aquarius, the sign, was in a different area of the year. Over time, because of an offset in the calculations, and I'm talking about an offset of maybe a couple of minutes every year, it has shifted an entire month, which is why we get this extra zodiac sign now. And
Aquarius.
Right. And it's only a week in there, because it is a week between Capricorn and the one right after it, which is now, and I can't ever remember that one.
I don't know anymore.
Anyway. But the symbols have actually been shifting seasons, okay? And what is supposed to be happening at this point is that the North Star is in the house of Aquarius for the next several centuries, rather than in the previous house that it was in, Sagittarius, I think. Okay? And that's why they call this the Age of Aquarius. Now, the moon in the seventh house is the seventh house is Aquarius, but that happens daily, okay? And Jupiter aligning with Mars happens probably about 6 to 8 times a year, depending upon how fast Mars is moving and where we are in the season, okay? So that happens all the time. But the Age of Aquarius is supposed to be this new age of the advancement of mankind, because Aquarius is associated with intelligence and spirituality and advancement, and which is where you get all of the indigo children coming from and all of these enlightened masters coming back and so on and so forth. It's supposed to be an explanation. In my personal opinion, however, it's a lot like ley lines. It's a nice mystical explanation for something that is actually pretty random.
I imagine that's the thing. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Personally, with ley lines, I have my doubts. I can't say I've experienced them or gone out of my way to look into them, but they seem to be better known over in Europe and in the UK. Mm-hmm. So I tend to have my doubts that they are generally a real thing.
Okay, my theory on ley lines is this. We have a circulatory system for our blood in our body, okay? We also have a circulatory system for the energy in our body that is typified by the chakras and the acupressure points on the body. Okay, this is well known. We've always known it. It's been around for centuries. People use it to very good effect. Why then would the Earth not have a similar system, okay, for energy flows? I do not think, however, that it is a straight line calculations from one point to another, because those seem pretty random, okay? What I think it is more like is more like a system of rivers and oceans for energy that exist on the astral plane that you can follow, where you have pools and you have flows and you have areas where things, you know, come together. But you have to access that in a different way, and it's not a map like the New Age people want you to see with the ley lines and Stonehenge and everything like that. That's my personal theory. It makes more sense to me, though.
That is an interesting theory, though. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess it's probably something that I have to, like, consciously go and look into.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are sacred sites around here that are supposed to be, you know, high energy points, but, you know, again, I haven't gone out of my way to look into them, so.
There are sites in the planet that have high energy. Some of it, I think, is natural gathering points for the energy, like Broceliande, the forest in Brittany. Others, like Stonehenge, I think they are natural gathering points simply because so many people come there and put so much energy into the area. I'm not going to say that Stonehenge is not on a nexus point for one of the ley lines, because it probably is. But when you have 100,000 people going there every solstice and equinox and doing major rituals...
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, there's bound to be a level of energy built up because people are using the spot.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, if there were not people going there and doing it, would it still be as energetic as it would have been? I think it would
be... Well, that begs the question, does the bear shit in the woods? You know?
Yeah.
You know, if a tree falls in the woods and there's no one to hear it...
Does the butterfly still flap its wings? You know? I think it would still be energetic, but I don't think it would be as energetic as it is now or has been in the past. Because there's, you know, another thing with Stonehenge Unraveled, where it's talking about this entire procession over a day and the ceremonies that could have been there, and there's archaeological evidence to back it up, and it was just absolutely fascinating. But yeah, there are natural areas that are natural gathering points for energy, for white energy, for black energy. You know, battlefields have a lot of negative energy in it, and there you can still feel it decades, centuries afterwards, and somebody has to go in and clean it up. You know, so it's another one of the things sure. Guardians do, and it's fun at times. So, okay, we got about 15 minutes left in the episode, minus what I edit out. We've talked about just about everything under the book, under the sun.
Sure.
There's a lot of things about Imbolc. Imbolc is I've always found it to be one of those orphan sabbats. Everybody knows a lot about Samhain. Everybody knows, even with a cursory search, a lot about Beltania. You can find tons of information if you type in Letha or Lusnada, because of the association of Lus Samhaldanich of the Tuatha De Danann in Ireland, declaring that to be the funeral games for his foster mother. And there's a whole celebration around that. But you can't really find a whole lot of information about Imbolc. Hopefully, this started a few people going, I wonder why that is, and they'll go out and start doing some research. There is information out there. Unfortunately, a lot of the information is also repeats of what other people have said about things that other people have said about what people have written about so forth and so on. Okay, it's regurgitation of information. Mike Nichols' article on Candlemas is one of the few exceptions. There are the various traditions, beliefs on the holiday itself as well. There is the celebration of Brigid and Groundhog Day and Olmec all together. And if you search under those, you'll find information on them. And mostly this is a celebration of the male half of the family. It is a time when we can say, dearest God, Lord, whoever, we love you. We appreciate you. You are an essential part of our life. You help us. You bring us food. You support us and sustain us. Be healthy. Be safe. Be kind. Show us what we need to do for the rest of the year. Help us. And to be honest, this is, you know, one of those things that also needs to be done. You have to have a time period when you can sit down with your dad eventually and go, Dad, thank you. I love you. And I will guarantee you, if you sit down and sincerely say that to your father, whoever he is and whoever you are, he will get gushy and flattered and go, you're welcome. Because it's very rare that fathers get thanked for what they do. One of the things that I was thinking of, again, is you have a father who has a child. He teaches that child. He shows the child how to go out and work the fields, how to change the oil in the car, how to be a good, upright person, how to get a job, how to discipline themselves and stick to a project until they're done. And so the child grows, and they go out, and they start succeeding, and they get a job. And somebody decides that they want to recognize this child for being a good person. And invariably, the child will get up there and go, I'd like to thank my mother and my sisters and this person and that person. And there's never any acknowledgement of what the father has done. But the father's been just as involved as anything else. And I'm not saying you have to have a traditional family of one dad and one mom. Or one male and one female. You can have two males, you can have two females, but there's always going to be somebody that takes the more active role in protecting the family and providing for the family, and somebody who is usually more the person who nurtures the family and makes the meals, and a more traditional feminine role. Okay, and so there's rarely any acknowledgement of the male half of everything. There's always an acknowledgement of the female half. Bill Cosby had a really good routine where he's, you know, talking about taking his son out and teaching him to play football and passing with him and running plays and thinking about this and, you know, taking him to peewee football and having everything. And then he gets up there and he's in the professional fields and the dad's all up and, you know, everything, and the cameras are on his son and showing him, and he's waving at the camera and he says, hi, Mom. And everybody laughed. I didn't, because that's what happens. Now, yes, moms do just as much. Moms get acknowledged by Wicca far too much, and in most paganism far too much. And it's time to start also acknowledging that there are many, many good things that come from the male.
It's true. They are not just sperm donors.
One of the greatest things is that anyone can be a father. It takes a real person to be a dad. And I got to say, one of my big, big regrets with my transition from male to female is that I'm leaving behind all of the male aspects and all of the accomplishments I had as a father, because my daughter grew up into be a wonderful young lady. She's kind, she's nice, she's generous, she's thoughtful. She doesn't judge. I raised her for the first 6 years of her life. I was the house husband. Mary went out and worked and provided for us. And I was dad to her. And it was a real hard thing to give that up to go to being female. And one of the big surprises that happens anytime we're out in public and I'm dressed as Joy and got my long hair on and the makeup and the skirts and everything is Rhiannon will come running up to us and say, Dad, look at this. And everybody looks at me and is like, what? Because she feels that the title dad is more important than my name. And you know what? I feel exactly the same. And I have no problem with her calling me dad.
Nor should you, I mean.
And it's one of the
for
weird...
all intents and purposes. I mean, you are her father, so...
Yeah. It's really weird because Mary will say something and Rhiannon will say, well, Dad's up in the bedroom and she's going to, you know, change and make the bed and come down here later and help us, you know, do dinner. And people are like, Dad and she. And it's kind of funny to watch them process that.
That might confuse people if they heard it like the first time.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a strange one for people.
Huh. So, instead of Father's Day, remember your dad on this day. Incorporate those celebrations in. Yes, acknowledge the female, and yes, acknowledge bride in your everything. Also recognize that, you know, this is a time for crafting and for preparing for the start of the year. Even though we had the new year back on Samhain, this is the start of when everything, the cycle starts of growing in life, actually starts coming together. So remember those. And don't get sidetracked by mundanities with the name and different symbols and stuff. It's all essentially the same celebration when you strip everything off. It's a celebration of life. There's
exactly.
Yeah, Mike Nichols came out with a book. He republished the Sabbaths in a book format, and also came out with two new articles that he included in there. One of them is a examination of the cycle, the wheel of the year, as you would be living it, starting from Samhain, going all the way through and around, and how the awareness expands and then contracts over the year. You start off with a celebration that is you and yourself and your health, and then it's your family, and then it's your immediate nuclear family. Then it's your homestead. Then it's your community. Then it's, you know, your entire country. And then it's your community again. And then it's your homestead again. And then it's your nuclear family. And then it's you again. And it was a fascinating look. And I went, wow, because my brain just went, pfft. It was.
There's always stuff doing that to your brain.
Oh, God, man, I love it.
Your brain on random things.
I love it when it does that, because when that soft hammer blow hits you right between the eyes, you are the most open to new ideas at that point. And when something that somebody else writes hits you with that, it's this connection to everything. It's about as close as getting to God that you can, in my opinion. Because suddenly all this new imagery and all this new information floods in, and all these scattered pieces that you picked up from random places around your life suddenly coalesce into this picture that's gorgeous. You may forget it 5 microseconds later, but for that one instant, it makes this unified whole that is just dazzling to behold. It's great. So, anyway, anything else from you?
Can't think of anything, no.
All right. Well, that's the show for the half month, everyone. If, you know, you want to get in touch with us, we've given you multiple times to how to get in touch with us. Joy@magicalmusings.net, Brian@magicalmusings.net, our Tumblr addresses. The website
is already now.
Magicalmusings.net. We have all of our episodes archived there. So if you find us through iTunes, you only see the 12 episodes that are up there. And I say 12 even though that this is episode 11, because we had one episode called Magical Mondays, which was going to be the new show that we kind of changed around the format so much that we decided to rename it Magical Musings. And that is still relevant, because that's talking about how to make your magical books and everything like that. So we have 16 episodes of Tarot Talk up there. If you ever want to go to the website and listen to them, please feel free. We would love for you to. You can make comments on the episodes themselves right there. You can send us emails right there if you want to. Please, we love hearing back from you guys. I gave you the shout-out to Anne at the very beginning of the show, because so far she's the only listener that has ever written us and talked about an episode that we've had up there. She's corresponded with me for about a week now and told me how she thought we had thousands of listeners. And it's like, no. We have maybe a dozen, I think. So we'd like to hear from you.
On a good day, we do.
You know, we track the times that it's accessed on our website. And barring two episodes, no episode has gotten really over 20 hits before the next episode was up.
Which two episodes was that?
Well, one was Galena's episode with the Northern Tradition.
Nice.
And that's because she was promoting it on her site, too, so all of her followers came over and was sharing it with us. The other one is The Myths of Paganism. That got
that does seem to be popular.
Yeah, it got like 50 hits the first week, and I was like, what the hell is going on here? I was hoping it was the start of something.
Well, at least it puts the word out there. I mean, I think one of the important aspects with that one is that it does address some of the weird misconceptions and, you know, pop myths. But folks, if you want to have us do another show that deals with more myths, let us know the myths you want us to tackle. It could be like pagan Mythbusters.
Yes. Hey, that'll work. I don't look good in a beard, though.
I happen to be wearing one.
Yes, you can be Jamie then.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, these are things that people think about all the time and
wonder about, and they can't find answers on their own because their teachers don't know either.
And often, too, I mean, the books sort of encourage these myths because they just sound really good. You know, like, okay.
Yeah, it sounds really sexy. It sounds really sexy to have 9 million witches persecuted over a 50-year period in England, when it's like, no. Actual records indicate maybe 100,000 over a 200-year period.
Well, that's the thing too. Like someone said, if that number were accurate, it would basically be depopulating half of Europe.
Yeah.
Thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is that. And, I mean, anyway, I mean, that's something we can address again in another myth show. So, enjoy the next fortnight, folks. Hit us up with questions, comments, ideas for shows, you know.
Thoughts, comments, criticisms. You know, normally we have an outline for what we want to say, but this one, 2 days ago I realized we had a show that was due on Thursday, and it was like, oh, shit! and I actually said that in the email I sent to Brian, and it's like, okay, well,
that's
we're going to do this one off the cuff.
But I think that's where we do our best work, too.
It is.
I mean, that's what this show came out of, from Tarot Talk. I mean, we addressed certain things, and we riffed for an hour, and hell, that
we
was
had
fun
with it. Yeah. Yes, it was. It was really great. I loved it. So we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. We have no idea what we're going to do then. Most likely it's going to be about books to avoid and books to read for starting knowledge. That's what we have on the schedule, but that's not written in stone anymore. So,
that does make a good point, because I think there's books that people never hear about because every author nowadays is encouraged to, you know,
reinvent the wheel.
Books from their particular author, you know, their particular publishing company, and then it's like the last 10 years is all the knowledge you'll ever need, and it's like, what are you talking about? Goddamn, 25 years ago, you had to scrounge for the slightest possible reference to, you know, a deity that might not be Christian, etc. So,
and people would
there's
be
lots of three that people never hear about.
A lot of the pagans that are in the pagan chat rooms these days would be, if you ask them what Gardner said in High Magic's Aid, they would be really hard pressed to tell you, because
or Dion Fortune in Sea Priestess. That was a good novel too.
Yeah, there's also the Golden Bough. There's you know, books like this, the classics of paganism, where we get a lot of this information, we get a lot of the associations. You know, if you ask most high priestesses these days what Saturnalia was and what relevance it has to us now, they'd be going, huh? What the hell? Saturnalia? That's a planet, isn't it?
Yes, it's the cult of the planet.
Mm.
It is an orgy associated with the planet Saturn.
So, anyway, that's for right now the topic for next show, but that could change. Announcements
don't
will be up on the website.
Don't criticize this changing.
There is a subscription link on the front page. Please sign up for it. Anything that is posted will be sent out by email to everybody that has it. So far, we have 2 people that are signed up for it, and I'm one of them. Yeah, I'm one of them. So.
Fascinating.
Oh, boy.
Actually, if you're following either of us on Tumblr too, you'll get all the new posts from Magical Musings on there.
Mm-hmm. And we do put up
it's all connected.
We do put up posts, short ones that have nothing to do with Tarot Talk or Magical Musings, just things of interest for the pagan community. Like I put up a post about being green without spending a whole lot of money, and using LED Christmas lights as your lighting source rather than incandescent lamps. You know, has nothing to do with.
Did you know that Canada is actually dispensing with incandescent bulbs? They're actually forcing everyone to use compact fluorescents.
America's trying to do it too.
Figures.
All right, so that's the show. Talk to y'all in 2 weeks. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.